Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy to see if you could save when you bundle your home and auto policies. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Summer's here, and Nordstrom has everything you need for your best dress season ever. From beach days and weddings to weekend getaways and your everyday wardrobe. Discover stylish options under $100 from tons of your favorite brands like Mango, Skims, Princess Polly, and Madewell. It's easy, too, with free shipping and free returns, in-store order pickup, and more. Shop today in stores, online at Nordstrom.com, or download the Nordstrom app.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today's episode is going to be part of our weekly docket series where I recap the top headlines in true crime this week. We've got a lot on the docket for today, and I've got a lot of requests, especially for a case happening out of Washington where a father is wanted in the murder of his 3 daughters. I posted on our Instagram for recommendations for cases. So if you ever want to recommend a case either for a deep dive or for a weekly docket, you can either go to mamamystery.com and there's a white box at the bottom of the screen where you can send me a message, or you can let me know on Instagram at mama.mysterypodcast. So without further ado, let's get into the top stories this week. In one story that has horrified the nation, authorities in Washington state are in the midst of a manhunt for 32-year-old Travis Decker, who was accused of killing his 3 young daughters during a parental visitation. Now, what began as a missing child alert last week turned into a complete nightmare. The Decker sisters, Peyton, who's 9, Evelyn, who's 8, and Olivia, who's 5, were supposed to spend the weekend with their dad as part of a court-ordered visitation. So when Travis failed to return the girls to their mother, Whitney Decker, on Friday, May 30th, she reported them missing that night. An endangered missing person alert went out, but notably, no Amber Alert was issued due to a strict criteria not being met. And this, of course, is a decision that would later spark public outrage.
For two agonizing days, police and volunteers searched, hoping to find these sisters alive. Then came the tragic discovery on Monday, June 2nd, when the bodies of Peyton, Olivia, and Evelyn were found near a remote campground in Chelan County, Washington. It could be Chelan or Shellen, I'm not sure, so please forgive me if I mispronounce it. But investigators soon revealed the disturbing details. Travis Decker's white pickup truck was located abandoned near the Rock Island campground where the girls' bodies were recovered. Two bloody handprints were found on the truck's exterior, and inside it, officers discovered a blanket, food, the children's car seats, and Travis's wallet on the console. Nearby, they found a tent and cooler, suggesting that the father had been camping out there recently, and a preliminary coroner's report indicates that the three sisters died by asphyxiation, so they were likely suffocated. And it's really just such a chilling detail that underscores the brutality of this crime. And it eerily reminds me of Chris Watts. And I can't help but picture Bella and Celeste in the back of Chris's truck, Bella knowing that she was about to suffer the same fate that Celeste did. And it makes me think of what these sisters likely went through, having to witness at least one or both of their sisters be killed by their own father. The tragedy is unfathomable. I can't even hardly stomach it. It makes me so physically sick to think about it. But based on cell phone records, police believe Travis had scoped out that campground a day before the killings, perhaps as part of his plan, but by the time the girls were discovered, Travis Decker had vanished into the vast wilderness of central Washington. As of this week, he remains at large, considered armed and very dangerous because he's a former Army service member who could be survival savvy in the outdoors, and he also could be armed. Even with him missing, prosecutors moved to charge Travis Decker with three counts of first-degree murder and one count of first-degree kidnapping for his daughter's deaths. He's also charged with custodial interference for failing to return the girls, though that now seems like the least of the offenses. I'm assuming that the prosecution is probably just trying to throw everything at this case so that he could be charged to the fullest extent if and when he's found alive. Now, wanted posters for Travis's description, being 5'8", 190 pounds, with black hair and a ponytail. I'll have the pictures on this video format of this episode, and as well as on our Instagram. But these pictures of him have been all over social media and media outlets. Multiple agencies, local police, county deputies, state troopers, even U.S. Marshals are scouring the region. The search has included door-to-door checks, helicopter flyovers, and tracking canines. As more background emerged, public outrage grew even louder. This was not a case that came completely out of the blue. There were red flags leading up to the tragedy. Court documents obtained by local reporters revealed that Whitney Decker had been growing alarmed about Travis's mental stability for over a year. The couple divorced back in 2023, and at first, Whitney did not seek any protective orders, initially reporting that there were no concerns about abuse or neglect in the parenting plan. But by mid-2024, Travis's behavior had deteriorated. He'd lost his housing and was essentially homeless, sometimes even having the girls sleep overnight at an armory with a group of other men when it was his weekend, so clearly not an ideal situation for their daughters. Whitney petitioned to the court to amend the visitation rules, asking that Travis not be allowed unsupervised overnight visits until he got his life together. At a court hearing on September 27th in 2024, her attorney told the judge that Travis was more and more unstable and needed a domestic violence and psychiatric evaluation. The judge agreed to modify the custody arrangement, citing Travis's issues with neglect and emotional problems. He ordered Travis to undergo anger management and a psych evaluation and shortened visitation to daytime hours on weekends. But here's the infuriating part. It appears that Travis never complied with the court-ordered evaluations or counseling, and yet he still retained visitation rights. By May of 2025, he was supposed to only have the kids during the day, not overnight. But on Friday, May 30th, he somehow had the girls past 9 p.m. and did not bring them home. Whitney told police that when Travis picked the kids up that day, he was quieter than usual, which struck her as odd. We now know that earlier in the day, Travis had packed up camping gear and likely planned out what he was going to do. The system that was meant to protect these children, court oversight, mental health intervention, etc., ultimately failed. And it's a story that I'm getting so sick and tired of hearing. But this realization has fueled an outpouring of anger and grief on social media. And it begs the question, why were these babies allowed with a dad who was clearly a ticking time bomb? And another contentious aspect is that an Amber Alert was never issued. When the girls went missing Friday night, the Washington State Patrol decided not to issue an Amber Alert because the case didn't meet the strict 5 criteria. For example, they didn't have a specific vehicle description at first, besides being with father, and custody exchanges can muddy the whole abduction definition. And so instead, they treated it as an endangered missing person advisory. And in hindsight, many are criticizing that decision, believing that an earlier, broader alert could have mobilized more help before it was too late. USP has publicly explained that they wanted to issue an Amber Alert, but were constrained by the rules, noting that the circumstances did not meet the requirements, despite frantic discussions with local police from Friday onward. So this has sparked debate about whether Amber Alert policies should be more flexible in custodial cases where danger is evident. For the community of Wenatchee, Washington, and indeed people across the country, this case is heartbreaking. A GoFundMe campaign for the girl's mother, Whitney, described the loss as immeasurable, and in just days, it raised nearly $400,000, a testament to the wave of sympathy and support for this grieving mom. Comments from donors and well-wishers pour in, and the girls were remembered as bright, joyful children involved in dance and theater with their whole lives ahead of them. Now, candles and flowers pile up outside their elementary school in an impromptu memorial. A local vigil drew hundreds of residents clad in pink and purple, which were the sisters' favorite colors, determined to celebrate their short lives. At the vigil, there was also palpable rage in the air with calls for reforms and family court, demands that Travis be brought to justice, and an unmistakable sense that the system failed these kids. And authorities are now vowing that Travis will be found and held accountable. Now, my initial thoughts about this case are that mothers should have more of a say in what they deem to be safe and appropriate for their children when it comes to visitation. If there are serious concerns like that, the mother of all people should be heard. It shouldn't be up to a judge and lawyers to defend this case who are standing from the outside. And listen, I know that the lines are blurry because some moms are just vindictive and want to keep their kids away from their ex for more personal reasons. But if a mother has a genuine concern for the well-being of their children, the safety of their children, and it's substantiated by evidence and facts, then the mother should be able to make a call when it comes to handing their children off with someone that they deem to be dangerous. It shouldn't have to go through the court systems. So I do believe there needs to be some reform. I don't know exactly what that looks like, but I just get so sick and tired of hearing these cases where a mother is afraid of being held in contempt of court for sending her child off with someone that she knows that is unstable and dangerous, possibly under the influence or having a mental breakdown. Like, the mother should be able and allowed to make that determination without having to go through all the jumps and hoops of a court system. But I also understand how muddy that can get. So I don't know what reform looks like, but something has to change. Now, in our next story that was highly requested, Mr. John Paul or J.P. Miller's recent wedding was anything but a simple celebration of love. It's become a lightning rod for true crime sleuths and the public. So on June 1st of 2025, just 13 months after the tragic death of his second wife, Micah Miller, JP married Susie Skinner in a picturesque Myrtle Beach ceremony. Now, normally a pastor finding love again might be heartwarming, but context is everything. Micah's April 2024 death was officially ruled a suicide by gunshot, yet friends and family immediately voiced their doubts. Micah had been in the process of divorcing JP, and in the weeks prior, she told police that she was afraid for her life, even finding a tracking device on her car. JP himself was the first to publicly call Micah's death a suicide, but those close to Micah did not buy it. She'd been making plans for the future just days before, and two separate memorials were held, one by JP and one by Micah's friends, who clearly distrusted him. So in short, many suspect that there's far more to the story of Micah's death. But the plot thickens with the new Mrs. Miller. So Susie Skinner's previous husband, Chris Skinner, died under bizarre circumstances as well. He was found drowned in a community pool on Labor Day of 2021. Now, Chris was a paralyzed motivational speaker, driver, whose wheelchair allegedly suddenly accelerated into the water. That death was deemed a tragic accident at the time, but we've since learned that J.P. Miller and Susie were allegedly having an affair before Chris died. In an affidavit, J.P.'s ex-wife, Allison Williams, claimed that Chris Skinner confronted J.P. just 2 weeks before he drowned, telling him to stay away from Susie and her kids. Eerily, J.P. phoned Allison extremely upset the same day that Chris died, asking her to pray. With both JP's and Susie's former spouses now dead in unusual incidents, online sleuths can't help but raise eyebrows. It's eerily similar to Lori and Chad Daybell. Now, federal investigators are reportedly re-examining Chris Skinner's death as part of a broader probe into JP Miller. All of this made the beachfront wedding a media spectacle. News Nation's Ashley Banfield even ran a segment highlighting how the wedding took place barely a year after Micah's death. Social media exploded with reactions. Many people expressed outrage that JP would move on so quickly, some dubbing the ceremony the Myrtle Beach Mystery Wedding. Now, to be fair, JP and Susie's supporters argued that these two individuals found love after shared grief. Both were widowed and have young children, and the couple themselves say that they've been unfairly judged by people who don't know the whole story. At the wedding, JP, who remains a devout pastor, spoke of faith and healing, saying, quote, "Just because you remarry after being widowed doesn't change the love for your former spouse." Now, it's a sentiment that might be sweet in another situation, but in this case, it struck many as being tone deaf. Meanwhile, legal troubles swirl around J.P. Miller. He has not been charged in connection with Micah's death, but he's hardly in the clear. In late 2024, the FBI raided J.P.'s home and church amid unspecified investigations. Days later, he was arrested for allegedly assaulting a woman protesting outside his church, a protester who believed JP was involved in Micah's demise. He now faces an assault and battery charge from that incident. Additionally, in February of 2025, an anonymous woman who is labeled Jane Doe Number 1 filed a lawsuit accusing JP of sexually assaulting her when she was a minor as part of a broader pattern of abuse at his former ministries. The suit even cites a sworn affidavit from Allison Williams, who is JP's ex, saying JP confessed to past inappropriate conduct with underage girls in the church. JP, for his part, denies all of these allegations, of course. He also notably took a polygraph test regarding one accuser's claims and reportedly passed. Still, a lot of smoke is surrounding one man. This week, one of the most shocking developments in the world of reality TV and true crime unfolded as former reality stars Todd and Julie Chrisley received a full presidential pardon from Donald Trump. So let's unpack this whole saga. I got a lot of requests for it, so there's a lot to cover. And if you'd like to skip this story because you're not interested in reality TV or politics, the timestamps are in the show notes, so you can go ahead and skip to the next story if you want to. But if you are interested, I'm going to go ahead and give you a recap of what the convictions were and what exactly happened here. So back in 2019, Todd and Julie, known from their reality show Chrisley Knows Best, were indicted on a slew of federal charges, including bank fraud, wire fraud, conspiracy, and tax evasion. Prosecutors accused the couple of running a decade-long scheme, falsifying documents to secure more than $30 million in loans, and hiding income to avoid paying taxes. Their trial was sensational, lasting 3 weeks in May and June of 2022. Prosecutors presented emails, documents, and testimony that painted a pretty damning picture. They accused Todd and Julie of living lavishly off fraudulently obtained loans, then filing bankruptcy to escape millions in debt. They also allegedly hid reality TV earnings from the IRS, and Julie was charged with obstruction for giving investigators fake documents. The defense countered that the Chrisleys were victims, specifically blaming Mark Braddock, a former business partner. Todd claims that Braddock forged documents and impersonated him to commit the fraud out of revenge for being fired. Braddock admitted on the stand to impersonating Todd, but said Todd directed him to do it. In the end, the jury sided with the prosecutors. Todd got 12 years and Julie got 7, and both were ordered to pay nearly $18 million in restitution. They went to separate prisons in January of 2023 and were not allowed to contact each other the entire time. Now, from day one, the Chrisleys have loudly claimed their innocence, insisting that they were wrongfully convicted. They pointed to several alleged injustices, including misconduct by investigators and prosecutors. In one high-profile incident, they settled a $1 million lawsuit against a Georgia tax investigator who allegedly targeted them improperly. Todd Chrisley repeatedly named Braddock publicly, accusing him of orchestrating the entire fraud scheme without their knowledge. Todd stated firmly after his pardon, saying, quote, "I would have remorse if it was something I did, but I didn't do it." Now, Julie echoed this sentiment, emphasizing their claims of innocence and wrongful conviction. Meanwhile, their daughter, Savannah Chrisley, became their fiercest advocate. Taking custody of her younger siblings while her parents were imprisoned, she launched a public campaign to free them. She hosted her podcast, Unlocked, highlighting what she believed was clear government misconduct and rallying public support. In summer of 2024, Savannah took her advocacy to new heights, speaking at the Republican National Convention and personally lobbying Trump's inner circle. She built relationships, appeared in high-profile media interviews, and continually pushed the narrative that her parents were victims of a corrupt system. Her persistence paid off when Trump personally called her in May of 2025 to announce the full pardon. So on May 28th, President Trump officially pardoned Todd and Julie Chrisley, effectively wiping their convictions from the books. Trump publicly commented that the couple had faced overly harsh treatment, suggesting that he believed their sentences were excessive. Todd and Julie were reunited with family within hours after 2.5 years behind bars and zero contact. Now, the pardon was unconditional, meaning that the Chrisleys' criminal records were cleared, though the financial repercussions remain uncertain, particularly the nearly $18 million in restitution that's owed. But legal experts are divided on whether they'll still have to repay those debts, since pardons generally don't erase financial restitution obligations. So what is next for the Chrisleys? Well, now that they're free, Todd and Julie are already planning for their comeback. Lifetime announced a new reality series following their journey through prison and pardon, promising an inside look at their fight for justice. Todd publicly stated that they are eager to set their record straight, implying new revelations about their case could emerge soon, likely through this new reality TV show. Savannah insists that the pardon was about correcting a wrong, firmly denying any inappropriate or unethical tactics were used to secure it. She credited God and Trump for her family's reunion, and Todd has repeatedly said that they are ready to rebuild their lives openly and honestly. For now, the Chrisley family saga has taken a remarkable turn from convictions and prison sentences to presidential pardons and public redemption. Whatever happens next, the Chrisleys have clearly managed to turn their story from a cautionary tale into an extraordinary second chance at freedom. Let's see what they do with it. If you're a fan of Keeping Up with the Chrisleys, or Chrisley Knows Best is what it is. I was thinking Keeping Up with the Kardashians. I don't watch that show, but the Chrisleys Knows Best is actually kind of a funny show. It just showcases their family dynamic, and a lot of their scenes are overly exaggerated, and it's obvious that they're kind of embellishing some of what their life is like. Like, they put themselves in these scenarios that I do think are kind of funny, and Todd is this very eccentric character that many people believe is gay, but he says he's not. Like, it's a whole reality show. I mean, there's a reason they have a reality show with multiple seasons that has done pretty well. So I understand they're an entertaining family, and I'm sure that their presence in the spotlight probably helped get eyes on their case, whereas there's many people who are behind bars, convicted of things they didn't do, or harshly sentenced for minor offenses. And Todd has addressed that, saying that there probably is a preferential treatment because of his status, but he is very vocal about his fight for the men that he met while he was in prison. And I think Julie has the same sentiment. So I think going forward, they're still going to fight for prison reform, but we'll just have to wait and see what that looks like. Now, last up, we have some Karen Reed updates. So I was following the trial on a daily basis, but it started to feel kind of monotonous, and it felt like there wasn't a lot to update. There were just these little tidbits that you could really kind of find on social media or TikTok. And so I wanted to kind of condense the updates into our weekly docket series so that if you want the updates for the Karen Reed trial, you can just find them here. So we are going to pick up where the prosecution or the Commonwealth left off. So they finally rested their case on May 29th, and the spotlight spotlight shifted to Karen Reed's defense team. So now the defense is going to present their case. After weeks of testimony accusing Reed of fatally striking her boyfriend, Boston police officer John O'Keefe, with her SUV and leaving him to die in a snowstorm, the defense now has its chance to tell a very different story. Her attorneys, Alan Jackson and David Yannetti, wasted no time. They immediately moved for a required finding of not guilty, which is a standard, like, please throw this out motion, which the judge denied. Nobody is surprised by that. But with that formality out of the way, the defense began calling its own witnesses to bolster their theory that John O'Keefe wasn't hit by Reed's Lexus at all, but instead was attacked inside the house at 34 Fairview Road and then left unconscious to die in the snow as part of a big cover-up. So what followed over the next several days was true crime drama at its finest. We've had contentious exchanges, surprising testimony, and a courtroom atmosphere that swung from tense to downright explosive at times. So I'm going to break down everything that's happened since the defense took over. The defense's first major witness was a Boston police officer named Kelly Dever, or Dever. And I laugh at that because she is really particular about how her name is pronounced, but I don't care enough to pronounce it correctly. She had been working for the Canton Police Department on the morning that John O'Keefe's body was found. Calling a law enforcement officer might sound like a safe bet for the defense, but this quickly turned into the most hostile witness moment of the trial so far. So Kelly had previously told FBI investigators that she saw two key figures, ATF agent Brian Higgins, a friend of John O'Keefe's who was also flirting with Karen Reed behind John's back, and then Canton Police Chief Kenneth Berkowitz, standing near Karen Reed's Lexus in the Canton Police Station garage, or the Sallyport, for a quote-unquote wildly long time on the morning of the incident. Now, this detail is huge because investigators later found fragments matching Reed's broken taillight at the crime scene, and the defense suggests that those fragments might have been planted. So Kelly's FBI statement seemed to support the idea that something fishy happened around Karen's SUV while it was in police custody. But when Kelly took the stand on Monday, her story did a complete 180. She retracted her earlier statement entirely, saying that she couldn't have seen Brian Higgins and the chief by the car because she had left work before Karen Reed's Lexus even arrived at the station. Now, according to Kelly, FBI agents showed her a timeline proving that she wasn't present at the crucial time, so she immediately corrected her claim. That alone was a blow to the defense's theory, but it got worse because Kelly didn't just recant, she also accused Reed's defense team of trying to pressure her into lying on the stand. So in a jaw-dropping exchange, she looked at Attorney Jackson and said, "You threatened to charge me with perjury during our phone call prior to the first trial if I didn't lie on the stand right now. I did not see anything. Factually, I've been provided evidence by a timeline that is not correct." Obviously, the courtroom was stunned as Kelly essentially suggested that the defense wanted her to repeat a statement that she now believes was false, a dramatic claim of attempted coercion in front of the jury. Alan Jackson, of course, denied this, and outside the courthouse, Karen Reed herself spoke up, telling reporters that they had subpoenaed Kelly Dever to testify to what she told other authorities and just wanted her to be as honest with us as she was with them. And then today, she's telling us what was a lie, essentially. This is kind of just summarizing what Karen Reed said. But Reed even remarked that Officer Dever seemed like a compromised person now. And it's not often that you hear a defendant publicly implying a police witness might be compromised, and it just underscores how high tensions ran after Kelly's testimony. Inside, Kelly's demeanor on the stand was openly frustrated and combative. At one point, she huffed audibly, even snapped at Alan Jackson for mispronouncing her name, so I'll play the clip and you can just listen to it for yourself.
I am put on the stand in a murder trial. I don't know why I'm here. I have no connection to this case.
Did you observe anything unusual that stood out in your mind that occurred, pardon me, in the Sallyport while you were on that shift?
So we've discussed this previously. I can't make that statement on the stand because I've been provided information released by the defense that it was not a memory, that it was a distorted memory. Therefore, I can't state it because at this point it would be a lie. I cannot make that statement that you're wanting me to make on the stand because I've advised that that would be a lie.
Ms. Dever, I've never asked you to make a statement one way or the other on the stand. I'm asking you an open-ended question.
Okay,
let me ask the question. Did you observe something in the Sallyport garage on January 29th, 2022 that you found unusual, that stuck out in your mind?
Given factual information that makes it so I know I did not, no.
So the answer is no.
Correct.
Do you remember being interviewed on August 9th, 2023?
I do.
That was by a separate law enforcement agency, correct?
Yes.
Two separate law enforcement agents, is that right?
Yes.
And you were advised during the course of that interview on August 29th of something, correct?
Can you rephrase that?
I'm sorry, August 9th.
So what was I advised of? Can you rephrase that?
Sure. Were you advised that lying to those officers would be a crime?
So it was a willing conversation. I've spoken with their legal team. Because of the fact I was providing factual information that showed a statement of mine was a false memory, it was not a lie. Therefore, I made it in good faith, and I retracted given information that it could not be accurate.
Mrs. Everett, did you understand my question?
Yes, I did. You threatened to charge me with perjury during our phone call prior to the first trial if I didn't lie on the stand right now. I'm telling you, I did not see anything. Factually, I've been provided evidence by a timeline that it is not correct.
Observers later called Kelly's turn on the stand a disaster, and one retired judge opined that she was a profile in courage for correcting herself and that the defense looked desperate by putting her on at all. Now, indeed, having one of your own witnesses undercut your theory and accuse you of impropriety is not exactly a defense home run, but whether the jury believes what she's saying now or what she said to the FBI is anyone's guess. Now, if Kelly's testimony was the firecracker, then the next defense witness attempted to provide the forensic explanation. Dr. Marie Russell is a retired emergency room physician and forensic pathologist. She took the stand to discuss John O'Keefe's injuries and why she believes they do not line up with a hit-and-run scenario at all. In fact, Dr. Russell has an alternate culprit in mind for at least some of John O'Keefe's wounds, being a dog. Yes, a large dog bite is the defense's answer to the injuries that the prosecution attributed to a vehicle impact. During the Commonwealth's arguments, they argued and they brought a expert on the stand who painted blue paint on his arm and then reenacted where the impact from the light would have been on his arm if he was standing behind Karen's SUV. This entire presentation was kind of crazy because this doctor, who apparently stood about as tall as John O'Keefe and weighed about as much as John O'Keefe, did this reenactment standing behind Karen Reed's SUV, or the exact copy of her SUV. He painted blue paint on the taillight and then let the car back into him at 2 miles per hour, showcasing where the paint would have ended up on his arm if he was John O'Keefe standing behind the car. However, there are so many issues with this because, one, the car backing up at 2 miles per hour is just simply not accurate. The Commonwealth was arguing that the car reversed at up to speeds of like 24 or 25 miles per hour, which is also, by the way, crazy to reverse that fast. Like, I would implore you to go to a safe parking lot, a safe area, and try reversing at 25 miles per hour and tell me how out of control that would feel. And especially when you're drunk, like, I can't imagine that somebody wouldn't sustain more severe injuries from being backed into a car at that speed. I would imagine that you would suffer way more bruising and like external injuries than just scratches on the arm. But these scratches were like gashes in his arm. And again, it just does not compute in my mind. And I have to wonder how the juries feel about this, because I've said it before on this podcast, but those marks, those gashes on his arm look like they would be way more likely to come from something like a dog than from being backed into by a vehicle. And they're suggesting that the taillight shattered and that's what caused those marks, but there's no DNA on the taillight pieces. So where do those cuts come from? It just does not make sense to me. And then of course the gash on the back of his head also doesn't make sense to me as to how it would come from being backed into by a vehicle. Dr. Russell testified that when she reviewed the evidence, she identified a cluster of wounds on John O'Keefe's right arm that she said, quote, "I believe were sustained by an animal, possibly a large dog." Now, this dovetails with the defense's long-suspected theory that the homeowner's German Shepherd, Chloe, might have attacked John O'Keefe during a melee inside the house that night. And to bolster her opinion, she pointed to physical clues. She noted puncture-like holes in John O'Keefe's clothing that, to her, look exactly like a canine tooth went through. And on the stand, she highlighted a photo of a hole in the sleeve of John O'Keefe's gray hoodie and explained, quote, "I believe that this hole was made by a canine tooth, with the tooth going into the shirt, reaching to the skin, and then coming out, pulling out some fabric with it." In her view, this wasn't a tear from glass or metal. It was a dog's bite mark. She emphasized that John O'Keefe's arm had distinctive round injuries consistent with teeth, not the rough scrapes that you might expect from, say, a broken taillight or plastic. Now, this testimony directly challenges the prosecution's narrative that the cuts on John O'Keefe's arm came from him being struck by her car. And if a juror buys Dr. Russell's analysis, then they might doubt that he was ever hit by a car at all. And honestly, that's all the defense needs to win their case. Dr. Russell's path to the courtroom is interesting in itself. She wasn't originally part of the case. She read about the John O'Keefe incident in a news article and found it so compelling that she reached out to the defense offering her expertise. She's actually from Massachusetts, but works in LA now, which is where defense attorney Alan Jackson once served as a prosecutor. Small world, but Dr. Russell has researched animal attacks and felt that she was uniquely positioned to interpret the autopsy photos with that angle in mind. On direct examination, she plainly stated that none of John O'Keefe's injuries, especially on his arm, looked like damage from being hit by a moving vehicle. There were no broken bones in his legs or pelvis, for example, which you might expect if a car struck him at like 25 miles per hour. Instead, many of the injuries were upper body, like head wounds, arm wounds, and abrasions, which she believes align more with the physical altercation being punched or struck with an object and an animal bite rather than a car impact. So unsurprisingly, prosecutor Hank Brennan came at Dr. Russell hard on the cross-examination. So hard, in fact, that it led to multiple objections and even a defense request for a mistrial. Brennan first tried to chip away at Russell's conclusions by pointing out that she saw no evidence of dog bites on other parts of John O'Keefe's body besides that arm, saying, quote, "Did you see anything you could attribute to an animal or dog attack on his legs, torso, or head?" And she, of course, conceded that she did not. So the implication is that if a dog had mauled him, wouldn't there be bites or scratches elsewhere? Which I don't think so necessarily. You can literally look at footage of police dogs who are training and they always go for the arm and they latch on there. And that's like the only place that they attack. So I don't think it's that crazy for there not to be abrasions anywhere else. But Brennan also noted that when Russell initially got involved, she spoke more cautiously about the wounds, saying that they could be animal bites or scratches, not definitively a dog attack. So now she seems more confident that it was a dog, and Brennan pressed on that shift in wording, hinting at inconsistency, but I feel like that's kind of a reach. Then things really heated up when the prosecutor ventured into the topic of DNA evidence, or rather, the lack of it. He started asking about whether any dog DNA was found on John O'Keefe's body or clothing. None has been presented, and the prosecution did not call a DNA expert for this trial. Defense attorney Robert Alessi immediately cried foul, arguing that this line of questioning was out of bounds. In a sidebar with the jury out of the room, Alessi angrily accused Brennan of violating a pretrial order by bringing up DNA results that were never introduced in this retrial. In fact, in the first trial, there had been DNA testimony, likely regarding whose DNA was or wasn't on John O'Keefe. But the prosecution chose not to present that this time. The defense essentially said, "You can't hint at evidence that isn't actually in this record." They moved for a mistrial with prejudice, meaning they wanted the judge to end the trial and bar a retrial, accusing the prosecution of such misconduct that Karen Reed shouldn't have to stand trial again. That's a high bar, and Judge Beverly Cannone did not go that far. She denied the mistrial request, but she did give both sides a clear ruling on the issue. The prosecution would be allowed to ask limited questions about the absence of dog DNA, so for example, pointing out that no dog evidence was found, but could not delve into any specifics from the first trial's DNA analysis or any inadmissible material. So in other words, Brennan could suggest to jurors, hey, if a dog bit him, we'd see some proof like dog DNA, which we didn't, but he couldn't go beyond that. Even with the judge's instructions, the back and forth between Brennan and Dr. Russell stayed contentious, and the defense team objected repeatedly, feeling that Brennan was badgering their expert. At one point on Monday afternoon, Judge Cannone decided to, cut the session short because of the constant friction. She told the court that they would resume the next morning, allowing everyone to cool off. By then, Russell had already held firm on her main points. She testified that the holes in John O'Keefe's shirt and the pattern of his arm wounds strongly suggest a dog's bite, not shattered glass. By Tuesday morning, the cross-examination continued a bit more calmly this time until Russell stepped down around midday. Now, as a side note, the judge also had to caution the jury during Russell's testimony that references to the first trial were off limits. So when Brennan tried to hint that Russell's testimony differed from what jurors heard last year, the defense bristled because technically jurors couldn't compare this trial to the previous hung jury trial. Judge Bev reminded everyone that this jury must consider only the evidence in front of them now, a constant challenge in a retrial that has become such a public saga. Now, after Dr. Russell, the defense shifted to focus on something more concrete, which was the condition of Karen Reed's Lexus SUV after the incident, and whether key evidence might have been tampered with. This led testimony from Officer Nicholas Barros of the Dighton Police Department, who was involved in the seizure of Reed's vehicle on January 29th. Now, Barros' account raised some eyebrows because it directly challenges the timeline of how Reed's rear taillight got broken, which is a critical detail in this case. Now, he testified that he was present when State Trooper Michael Proctor came to Reed's parents' home in Dighton to impound the Lexus on the afternoon of January 29th, just hours after John O'Keefe had been found. He arrived around 3:27 p.m. and did a walk-around inspection of Karen's SUV. On the stand, he said he specifically noted in his report that the vehicle's right rear taillight was cracked with a piece missing, but not completely damaged. Now, in other words, it had a minor break, a hole or crack, but the red lens was not entirely smashed out. Then Jackson showed Officer Barros a picture that the prosecution had entered into evidence, which was taken later when Karen's SUV was in the Canton police garage. Now, this photo depicts the Lexus's right taillight as utterly shattered, basically a gaping hole where the red cover should be. And Jackson asked him if that photo reflected how the taillight looked when he saw it in Dighton. And he did not mince words. He said, quote, "Absolutely not. That taillight is completely smashed out," making it crystal clear that something changed between the time that he saw the car and the time that that photo was taken. Reed supporters have long alleged that the taillight might have been intentionally damaged while it was in police custody. And now a sworn officer has basically confirmed the taillight was in much better shape initially than when photographed at Canton PD. So Karen Reed herself has been very vocal about this. After his testimony, she told reporters, quote, "It's on video. We all know when it was tampered with." And the defense claims to have surveillance video from that day that shows when and how the taillight got fully smashed, though that video hasn't been played in open court yet, at least not yet as of this week or at the time that I'm recording this. But still, his testimony gives the defense's argument a factual backbone. The car left Dighton with a partially intact taillight and arrived in Canton with a fully busted one. So Prosecutor Brennan handled the cross-examination very carefully, clearly aware that the accusations of evidence tampering are very serious. He started nitpicking inconsistencies between Barros' testimony now and his past statements. Brennan pointed out that when he testified in a prior proceeding, likely a hearing or maybe the first trial, he described the taillight damage in less detail. The subtext was that he might be embellishing now or remembering things differently with time. Brennan even reminded the jury subtly that there was a first trial, though he didn't explicitly call it that, since jurors aren't supposed to consider it. He just noted that he hadn't been cross-examined by the defense back then, implying that this is the first deep dive into his recollection. So the prosecutor also asked Barros about a meeting with the defense team at Jackson's hotel before testifying this time. This was likely an attempt to insinuate that he might have been swayed or coached to emphasize the taillight issue. Barros admitted to the meeting, but there was no indication that he ever changed his story. He consistently maintained that he knew what he saw and that smashed light was not it. Most dramatically, when Brennan confronted Barros with the actual video evidence to counter the tampering narrative, he played surveillance videos from January 29th of 2022. One clip of Reed's Lexus backing out of John O'Keefe's driveway in Canton in the early morning, and another clip later that day before the car was towed. In both videos, the taillight already appears to be damaged. You can see the broken area with snow caked into it, according to Brennan. And the prosecution's point here is that the taillight was shattered from the get-go, presumably from hitting something or someone, not due to any tampering. But if the jury believes that the video shows a fully broken taillight on the morning of the incident, then it undercuts the defense claim that police must have busted it later. Barros, for his part, stood firm that when he saw it up close in person that afternoon, it was only partially cracked, not the completely smashed out condition visible in photos and perhaps on video. On redirect, Alan Jackson clarified that Barros only observed the car in Dighton. He wasn't with Trooper Proctor and the vehicle during the subsequent hours in Canton, and this subtly reminded jurors that if something did happen to the taillight in Canton PD, Barros would not have been there to witness it anyway. By the end of Barros's testimony, the defense had planted a seed of doubt about the integrity of the physical evidence, a theme that they've hammered throughout the trial, from sloppy evidence collection with snowblowers and solo cups to an investigator's suspicious behavior in other aspects. Was the crime scene staged? Was the damage to the car exaggerated after the fact? Then, to further challenge the official timeline of John O'Keefe's death, the defense called a witness who literally saw the scene in the middle of the night. Brian Lucky Loughran is a Canton Town snowplow driver, and his route took him up and down Fairview Road during the overnight hours of the blizzard. And his testimony directly confronts the prosecution's claim that John O'Keefe was left out in the yard freezing from around 12:30 a.m. onward. If John's body had been lying in the front lawn most of that night, could a plow operator have missed it? Loughran says no. He's adamant that he never saw John O'Keefe on the lawn during his rounds. He testified that he clocked in for work at about 2:15 a.m. on January 29th, the night of the storm. He had an assigned plow route in Canton, and by around 2:45 a.m., he made his first pass by 34 Fairview Road. His plow truck, he noted, has extremely bright lights, like driving with a spotlight, illuminating the area very clearly. Defense attorney David Yannetti asked plainly, "What, if anything, did you see on the front lawn of the area of the flagpole?" And Loughran's answer was, "I saw nothing. No person, no shape, nothing unusual on the snow-covered lawn." Now, this was a powerful moment because that spot where he looked is exactly where John O'Keefe's body was discovered a few hours later by Reed and her friends. If John O'Keefe had already been there at 2:45 a.m., Loughran is certain he would have noticed something with all the light from his plow. And it wasn't just one drive-by. Loughran said that he continued plowing multiple passes on Fairview Road between 2 and 6 a.m., going up and down as he cleared the streets. Each time he went by the Alberts property, he looked and saw nobody lying in the snow. The defense highlighted this because if John O'Keefe truly had been there all along, it raises the possibility that Loughran would have at least spotted him on a subsequent pass, especially as more snow fell or if the body became more visible. So the fact that Lucky saw nothing suggests to the defense that John O'Keefe might not have been placed outside until closer to daybreak, consistent with their theory that something happened inside the house first. Loughran also provided an intriguing detail. Around 2:45 to 3 a.m., he noticed a Ford Edge SUV parked out front of the house. And this struck him as odd because he knew the family, the Alberts, would normally never leave their cars on the street overnight. He testified that the Edge arrived between 2:45 and 3 a.m., indicating he saw it appear where it hadn't been on his first pass. Now, why is this significant? Well, one of the residents of the house owned a Ford Edge, and if everyone in the house was supposedly asleep by 1 a.m., as some of them have claimed, then why would a car be coming or going around 3 a.m.? The defense pounced on this point outside of court, saying, quote, "John O'Keefe was killed inside that house and dragged outside, period." In the defense's narrative, that Edge might have been used by someone to either transport John O'Keefe's body out or otherwise involved in a cover-up during those wee hours. Now, notably, Loughran revealed that police never interviewed him in 2022 at the time of John O'Keefe's death. Now, despite being a town employee who was literally on the scene that night, he wasn't approached during the initial investigation. It wasn't until a year later, in 2023, that now-fired Trooper Proctor contacted him to ask about that night. The defense subtly suggests that this was a major investigative oversight, or perhaps an intentional avoidance. Why wouldn't investigators want to know if a plow driver saw anything unless they weren't looking too hard at alternate theories? Law firm didn't speculate on that, but the timeline just speaks for itself. On cross-examination, prosecutor Adam Lally attempted to poke holes in Loughran's memory and impartiality. First, Lally asked about a conversation that Loughran had in May of 2023. Apparently, he had told someone he arrived at work around 11:30 to 12:30 a.m. that night, which conflicts with the 2:15 start time that he testifies to now. And Loughran said that he had no memory of making that comment and maintained the official call time for plow drivers was 2:30 a.m., which aligns with his 2:15 arrival claim. So Lally's implication was that Loughran's recollection might not be perfect. If he was mistaken about when he started work, could he be mistaken about what he saw or when? Loughran stuck to his guns, though, on the timeline. Then came a rather unusual line of cross. Loughran was asked about Aiden or Turtle Boy Carney, who is a local blogger who has been passionately covering, and many say influencing, the public narrative of this case. So Turtle Boy's blog and social media have championed the theory of Karen Reed's innocence and the idea of a conspiracy or cover-up. The prosecution suggested that Loughran's testimony might have been swayed by reading or interacting with this external coverage. In fact, the headline in one news recap noted that the snowplow driver was questioned about the blogger's influence. While we don't have Loughran's exact response in the transcript that we saw, the very mention of Turtle Boy in court is telling. It shows how this trial isn't happening in a vacuum. The outside world's chatter is starting to seep in, and the prosecution likely wanted the jury to consider that Loughran, aware of the Free Karen Reed movement and theories floating around, might be unconsciously aligning his story to fit the defense's narrative. Did he actually see or notice the Ford Edge at 2:50 a.m. on a snowy night 2 years ago? Or did that detail stand out only after reading about it on a blog later? These are the kind of doubts that the prosecution hoped to plant. But from a courtroom drama perspective, Loughran's testimony was less fiery than Kelly Devers or Dr. Russell's, but it was still crucial. He is a regular guy, not a cop, not an expert, just a working man who was out there that night. And sometimes jurors lend a lot of credibility to an everyman witness with no obvious axe to grind. If they believe Loughran, then at minimum, there's uncertainty about when John O'Keefe ended up outside. And it supports the defense's timeline that something happened closer to 2:30 or 3 o'clock inside that house rather than Karen Reed hitting him around 12:30. And that, in turn, could raise reasonable doubt about Reed's culpability. Now, the thing I find interesting about this is that it points to the fact that the police never interrogated anyone else or even questioned anyone else about what they possibly saw. They were so laser focused and had tunnel vision on Karen Reed that they couldn't have suspected anything else. And I think that that bolsters the defense's theory that this whole investigation was shoddy at best. Lastly, the defense presented a witness to address Karen Reed's condition and behavior on the night in question, essentially to counter the prosecution's portrayal of her as a drunk, angry girlfriend who might have done something rash. So Karina Kolakithis, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but she is a friend of both Karen and John O'Keefe, and she took the stand after the snowplow driver. Her testimony was short and to the point, but it painted a very normal, non-confrontational picture of Karen in the hours before the tragedy. She was at the Waterfall Bar and Grill in Canton on the night of the incident. In fact, Karina ran into them around 11 p.m. when they arrived. She testified that she was actually about to leave the bar, but when she saw John and Karen come in, she stayed and spent some time with them. Now, according to her, she spent roughly 50 minutes talking with Karen Reed that night. During the conversation, she said, quote, "She seemed fine to me." And importantly, she added that Karen did not seem overly intoxicated. Karen wasn't slurring or stumbling or visibly upset. She appeared normal and in control. Now, Karina herself wasn't drinking alcohol, only water. So she was sober enough to observe Karen's state pretty carefully. And this directly rebukes any notion that Karen was blackout drunk or enraged at John O'Keefe that night. The prosecution had introduced evidence of some heated phone calls earlier in the evening, trying to cast Karen as jealous and angry, but Karina's account did not witness any of that firsthand. Now, just speaking as a juror, if I were witnessing that, I don't know that I would give too much credit to that testimony, only because they have the voicemails of her clearly upset when she was calling John O'Keefe after the fact, and she did seem mad. It did seem like they had maybe had some sort of disagreement or something after he got out of the car. And maybe she's trying to paint a picture that they were fine that night up until he got dropped off in front of 34 Fairview. But when you hear those voicemails of Karen calling John and just going off, calling him a pervert, saying that she fucking hates him and all of this, it just, I don't think that this really neutralizes that. We heard what we heard. However, I think with context, knowing that she thought he was going to come back and get her or at least communicate with her, and it pissed her off that she wasn't communicating with him or with her, that kind of explains the voicemails. So when it comes to Karina's testimony, maybe it helps, but if I'm a juror, I don't know that it really is going to sway me one way or the other. But I'd like to know your thoughts, what you think of the trial so far. I have had some people messaging me commenting about how a lot of the mainstream media is portraying this as a complete loss for the defense, and people like these analysts on TV saying that they believe the prosecution or the Commonwealth is winning so far. But I feel like what I'm seeing on social media in the court of public opinion, it's very much the opposite. They're all siding with Karen still. And if this jury is full of just regular people hearing all of this evidence at the same time that we are watching it streamed on live stream, I'd have to assume that the jury is kind of going in line parallel with what the public opinion is about this case. I don't know that legal analysts are really speaking more to the jury's perception of what's being presented as much as they are just chastising or critiquing the presentation by both teams. So I don't know if that makes sense. But anyway, that's my thoughts regarding the Karen Reed trial. And that is it for today's episode. So I will catch you next week with a deep dive on Tuesday, True Crime Tuesday, as usual. And also, we have a new podcast coming out called The Motherload. This is a podcast with me and my best friend, Carolyn Miljavik. She is a comedian. She's actually on tour right now. But in The Motherload, we talk about just everything that is topical, conversational, motherhood, relationships. We talk about it all. Nothing's off limits. So if you like the style of Mama Minutes, or you like just a conversational, topical kind of podcast, go check out The Motherload. You can also find us on Instagram at @the_motherloadpodcast. And that is it for today's episode. I'll see you next week. Stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. You chose to hit play on this podcast today. Smart choice. Make another smart choice with AutoQuote Explorer to compare rates from multiple car insurance companies all at once. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Affiliates. Not available in all states and situations. Prices may vary on how you buy.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.